No, it's, I was doing the headphones.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's just,
But this is independent.
Yeah. Please rise, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Riley, Judge Smith, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning, please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, we are today in courtroom 100 on April 17, 2019. This panel of the court today has six cases, four of which will be submitted with oral argument and two of which will be submitted without oral argument solely on the briefs. The first case set for oral argument is number A18-1487, Zahn Law Firm versus Ronald Baker. Counsel for appellant, you may approach. Please identify yourself and then begin. I think, as both of you know, you have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and then appellant's counsel has 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Appellant Ron Baker is also present. My name is Wendy Allison Nora, and I'm the attorney for Ronald Baker, the defendant in the district court action, and the appellant in this case. This case boils down to the proposition of whether or not Mr. Baker was entitled to a written settlement agreement due to the complexities of the issues that needed to be negotiated. Despite my efforts to inform the district court that there were issues that had to be resolved to have proper treatment in the bankruptcy court, that was not done. So the position that Mr. Baker has is that the written agreement, which was anticipated and proposed on the record, was necessary to resolve that complex feature of this case. Mr. Baker is a Chapter 13 debtor operating under a confirmed Chapter 13 plan. The effect of the district court's judgment is to alter the treatment of a pre-petition debt under the plan and is, in our position, void. But we have not sought to have it declared void. We appealed and have brought to your court, this court's attention, that the addition of interest on a judgment that was never consented to begin with, because the automatic stay in bankruptcy was in effect, remains in effect, and the confirmed plan is being followed. What occurred here is the district court acted outside of its jurisdiction.
So the respondent says there are four essential terms in the agreement. You say there's more than four. How many?
Five. Okay. The treatment of the settlement agreement under the bankruptcy.
So when you appeared in front of the district judge and asked the district judge to cancel the trial, you were aware, I mean, it's your position that you were aware of an issue that was essential to the agreement that had not yet been resolved?
Yes, and it was placed on the record as not being resolved.
I understand, but it was not placed on the record that you considered that to be an essential term of the agreement.
Well, because the terms that were set forth on the record in chronological order addressed that a further resolution would be forthcoming with respect to the treatment of the bankruptcy claim.
Right. That outstanding issue was acknowledged. But don't you think the district court understood that to be not essential, since the parties were coming forward, putting an agreement on the record, asking the district court to cancel the trial? It was not a continuance of the trial, right? This was not a continuance for further negotiations to give an extension of time, to give the parties more time to negotiate a settlement agreement. The parties came forward and said, we have a settlement agreement. Correct?
Well, actually, the jury would have had to have been excused for the day, so I don't see how that really makes a difference with respect to whether the case would be continued or resolved on the record.
But did you ask for a continuance?
We didn't think it was necessary because we had held our essential issue open. It was stated on the record. Further negotiations were engaged in. There was a deadline for the written settlement agreement to be submitted to the district court. Settlement, the negotiations broke down.
Can you explain why that issue is essential? In other words, what are the consequences of one approach versus the consequences of the other approach?
There is a separate case.
I understood.
In the bankruptcy court.
We know the background, but why is it essential that the resolution of the Hennepin County case not be reflected in a judgment?
Our position is that the way that the judgment is treated is essential.
Why?
Because the automatic stay was still in effect, and so you can't enter a judgment in a collection action without obtaining relief from the automatic stay the bankruptcy court.
Ordinarily, when there's an automatic stay in place, a state court cannot hold a jury trial.
That is correct.
Okay, so then, all the proceedings, the fact that you were in court in a Hennepin County courtroom is in itself inconsistent with the automatic stay, isn't it?
That was my position, and I took it up to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals that the remand order.
And you lost on that issue.
I did. The remand order was subject to the automatic stay, and I tried to call the court and counsel's attention to the fact we didn't lose on that issue. It was not determined. The clear terms of the remand
I haven't
order.
Read the bankruptcy appeal decisions. I have read the transcript before Judge Sandberg.
Okay.
She remanded the case back to the Hennepin County District Court.
For purposes of determining the value of the claim in bankruptcy.
Okay. And how would that determination be reflected in your view?
It would be determined by a full and complete settlement agreement in writing that could be presented to the bankruptcy court, resolving all of the issues, including the...
At the time of Judge Sandberg's remand, I mean, when she was remanding to the Hennepin County District Court for a determination, what was contemplated? Well, what procedures were contemplated, and how would the district court's determination be reflected? In what kind of a
The value of the claim in bankruptcy court would be determined.
Right. And the determination would take what form? What kind of a piece of paper would tell someone what the value of that claim is?
It would be by a determination such as a jury verdict if we proceeded to the jury trial, which would have not been able to be entered as a judgment, and it would have been... if we stipulated, it would have been in the written documentation that we would have obtained through negotiations.
Okay, if that is important for purposes of federal bankruptcy law, I would expect some legal authority on that point, some bankruptcy statutes or bankruptcy case law.
Indeed.
Have you provided that?
We have cited these applicable statutes, Your Honor.
Okay, I don't recall. I understand the automatic stay is Section 362, but...
And the confirmed plan is... The plan was confirmed under 11 U.S. Code 1325. And the confirmed plan does not call for interest on an unsecured dischargeable debt. These were matters that still needed to be worked out, plus the additional... enormous consideration that would have inured to the benefit of the third-party defendant.
Looking at page 13 of respondent's addendum, Judge Sandberg says the court finds that equitable remand under Section 1452B is warranted. So that I haven't done the research in federal bankruptcy law, but I was expecting to see more of that in the briefing. But there must be an exception to the automatic stay that's in that section, 1452B.
It is not. What is
1452B?
It's a provision that allows the bankruptcy court to remand a case to state court that has been removed from state court for a determination of the value of the claim, which is exactly what Judge Sandberg did.
And is there case law under 1452B about the form of that determination, whether it must or must not be in a judgment versus some other format?
Actually, Your Honor, Judge Sandberg states her expectation in that regard in that transcript where she says it would come back to bankruptcy court to be enforced. That's why it was held open for further negotiations as to how to articulate the resolution.
I've read the transcript of the morning of trial where Judge Regis canceled the jury because there was a settlement, which you say there wasn't a settlement. And so I'm trying to figure out in the transcript where you tell Judge Regis that you don't have a settlement.
What I told Judge Regis was that we needed a deadline to complete the negotiations.
To get the paperwork in is how I read the transcript. So I want you to point me to page and line where you tell Judge Regis that you do not have a settlement, and therefore, otherwise she wouldn't have canceled the jury and canceled the trial.
Well, what was said was that
point me to
the issue was held open for resolution.
Can you point me to page and line, please? Because she even asked Mr. Baker if he agrees that there's been a complete settlement and the case has been resolved, and he says yes, and she says, do you have any questions for me or your lawyer? No.
Indeed, and what I'm referring to is that part of the 5 points that was read onto the record, that was the outline of the resolution.
You've provided the transcript, and I want to be able to read the words, please.
Thank you. It's on, it's in our addendum B, page 3, or page 3 of the transcript of the proceedings to which you refer, and it's lines 13 through 22 sets forth what we were discussing. And
so I'm sorry. So there is different pagination. At the top it says addendum B3. Down here it says 3. So if you could just clarify, please.
The 3 that appears on the document, Your Honor, is the pagination of the transcript itself. And when it was assembled, the it's addendum B, and it's also page 3, because those are both the same page. And it's page 008 of the addendum.
Okay, I'm looking at that.
Then I'm trying to clarify on page 009. It's all claims and litigation between the parties. There's this action. There's the adversary proceeding in the bankruptcy court, and we are going to be resolving how to treat the claim in bankruptcy court is the 5th point on page 3 of the transcript.
How about page 7 of the transcript, where the court goes through in some detail making sure that there is an agreement?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then the court on page 8 says that how much time do you need to get the documents together, and it's said that it'd be done within a week.
Yes, precisely, because this is the type of settlement that is expected to be in writing, needs to be in writing, and that is why in our reply brief we directed the court to the Minnesota Supreme Court decision in which it lays out the criteria for a contract, which settlement agreements are, which need to be put in writing. And this,
the question is whether that's an essential term of the agreement or not. And the court was pretty specific about making sure that the parties were in agreement, not a potential agreement, but an actual agreement. Would you agree with that?
No, I would not, because I tried to articulate that this needed to be in writing and that it needed to be presented to the judge for review and that we needed a deadline. And I'm directing the court's attention to Massey versus Gibbs.
Where do you say that we need to put this in writing and we need a week to make sure we have an agreement?
The language that was used was that we would be preparing a written agreement, and I asked for a deadline for that to be submitted. The question of whether or not the term is essential is a mixed issue of law and fact, and that's why we cited the VoiceStream case, because the judge cannot, under the Constitution of the United States, simply impose a contract on parties, particularly not a party that is operating under a confirmed Chapter 13 plan in the exclusive plenary jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court, and say, this is how that claim will be treated in bankruptcy. To enter into the judgment, Mr. Baker would have had to consent to the stay to be lifted, and that's the point at which we were negotiating when the settlement agreement failed.
Your initial allotment of time has expired, but you will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Zahn?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Matthew Zahn. I represent the respondent. The first issue I'd like to address is the applicable standard of review in this case. The appropriate standard of review is an abuse of discretion, because in this case, the appellant is asking this court to set aside a settlement agreement that has been enforced by the district court. I think Your Honors were right on point where the critical issues in this case are, and it's whether the entry of judgment was an essential term of the settlement agreement reached by the parties in district court. The district court found as fact that there were only four essential terms to the settlement agreement, and that the fifth element that appellant has based his appeal on was an ancillary term to the agreement. The appellant does not provide or point to any record evidence upon which this court can reverse the district court's finding. But moreover, as the last few minutes of questioning indicated, the district court specifically addressed this on the morning the settlement agreement was read into the record. The district court spent, as Your Honor just pointed out, a fair amount of time to make certain that an agreement was reached, inquiring of the appellant to make certain that the settlement agreement was reached, that he intended to settle the case completely, to resolve it, to resolve two other pending cases before the United States Bankruptcy Court, to cancel a jury trial that was scheduled for that morning. And in fact, Judge Regis pointed out specifically that she did not intend to cancel or call off the jury trial unless the court was satisfied that a settlement agreement was reached, that a full and complete settlement agreement was reached. Only after the court took those precautions did the appellant agree and indicate his intention to be bound by those terms. This court should affirm that ruling. Appellant,
Mr. Zahn, I'm a little bit just curious about the background. After the summary judgment ruling, it seems like the issues had been narrowed, and I think the primary issue in dispute then was whether certain commissions received by Mr. Baker were included in the scope of representation. I'm wondering what was the value of the fees, or what, I mean, what was the difference in the dollar amounts, but what was the difference between the parties at that point?
What was left? It was a very small amount. I can't recall offhand the specific amount.
25% of the commissions, I suppose.
It was less than 25% of the contingent portion of the case.
And how much in commissions did he receive during that time frame?
It might be more helpful if I answered a different way, if I may. Sure. I think that what we had in dispute after summary judgment was an amount less than $10,000. Closer to $5,000, if I recall correctly. Okay. So most of the case had been resolved in summary judgment. And the summary judgment order also resolved the hourly fee portion of the attorney fee, okay, and awarded the respondent the full amount it was asking for under the representation agreement. And it awarded most of the commissions that it was seeking for on the contingent fee case. And if I recall correctly, I believe the ballpark was about 6 commissions were outstanding. I could go back and look, but that's my recollection after a fair amount of time has passed on that.
That's helpful. That's sufficient. Thank you.
Okay.
So you've referred to the bankruptcy code section that I mentioned in your brief. Is there case law, and you didn't cite any case law that elaborates on that. Is there case law to your knowledge?
Your Honor, I searched. I was unable.
And to elaborate, is there case law on the issue of the proper form in which the district court's determination should be reflected before the dispute goes back to bankruptcy court?
Sure. Not that I was able to find. So I researched that issue. I was unable to find it. And frankly, that comports with my understanding of the bankruptcy abstention doctrine, where typically what happens is bankruptcy court has a state court law issue that comes before it. And it says, I'm a bankruptcy court. I'm a court of limited jurisdiction. Okay. A state court is better suited to handle state contract issues, which was essentially what was at issue in this case. So it goes through a multi-factor test, and this is what Chief Judge Sandberg did in bankruptcy court, concluded that the factors for abstention were present, abstained from the case, and then remanded it back to state district court. And what happens then is that matter gets scheduled for trial and proceeds as it normally would, absent the bankruptcy. That matter should be concluded, okay? And of course, whether it's a trial or summary judgment, you typically end that with a judgment. That, and the purpose of the judgment is to determine the amount of the debt for bankruptcy purposes that is owed. When the state court proceedings conclude, the matter then goes back to bankruptcy court, okay, to say the amount of the debt is determined. We now take that determination as if the bankruptcy court had decided the correct amount of the debt. That amount is now listed as a creditor and an obligation for the debtor to pay, in this case, under his Chapter 13 plan. Okay. And that, frankly, is all we were asking. Now, in this case...
So just to be clear, so am I correct, you drafted a proposed settlement agreement?
The initial one, yes.
Right, and so in your initial draft, you were essentially contemplating that the parties would stipulate to the entry of judgment by the district court?
That is correct.
Okay. Well, I mean, why would it have not been effective if the parties simply used the agreement as the document which evidences the debt?
So the record provided in the appellant's appendix may not be as clear on that particular issue as might be helpful. There were multiple.
You're referring to all the emails. I haven't yet read those. It didn't look very appetizing, to be honest, and so I decided to refrain from that unless necessary.
But yes, and I I don't think reading the emails helps advance an understanding or resolution of this case, other than the email in Appellate's Appendix, page 32. I point that one out because it, I think, factually resolves this issue of whether the parties agreed that a judgment may be entered. Okay. What you'll see there in that email, and this is an email from Appellate's counsel to me, saying, initially, I hesitated as to the whether judgment could be entered, but upon researching the issue, I have concluded that it is appropriate and able to be done. Okay? So this issue that Appellant is raising, indicating that there was never an agreement about entry of judgment, and then basing this appeal upon that, frankly, lacks factual basis. Because you can see in the email, she is acknowledging it can be done, but ultimately, Appellant elected not to.
So
this is also cited in my brief as well, with the citation and reference.
Going back to my earlier question, I guess you're not aware of any case law that says that there's a particular wrong way to do it under 1452B or whatever is the number.
Right. And going back to the earlier question, so I'm not aware of any research that specifies that. It is my understanding that this is how it's done. The court decides it, judgment is entered, and then, of course, the automatic stay applies, and that's never been in dispute, right? Respondent understands
subject,
I can't collect that debt.
Subject to the remand.
Exactly right. Well, what happens is the automatic stay precludes me from enforcing that judgment and engaging in remedies, okay? So what happens is, and what the agreement contemplated, the settlement amount of $55,000 now gets taken to bankruptcy court, and then the respondent takes his place among the creditors with respect to the appellant's bankruptcy estate. In this case, it would be an unsecured, non-priority creditor and would be entitled to whatever pro rata share of the estate, and that's frankly all we were asking. Now, that dovetails to the next part that goes back to your earlier question. I initially drafted settlement documents, but there were a number of them, and it appeared that they were attached to the emails, but I couldn't see that those documents were necessarily attached to the appellate's addenda. But what is important is that there was a settlement agreement, there was an entry of judgment, a stipulated entry of judgment, proposed findings for the court to sign off on, and most importantly, a stipulation that the parties would sign that would then be submitted to the bankruptcy court to stipulate that the amount of the debt was $55,000 and that it was an unsecured non-priority debt. Okay. There was also various dismissals with prejudice to be signed as well, as you typically would expect. So there were a number of documents proposed along with that, and there was a lot of back and forth that frankly I don't think is relevant, other than to say those four essential terms were never changed in any iteration or revisions proposed in after the settlement was read on the record. As my time is running out, the last thing I'd like to address is appellant has taken the position that the district court needed to hold an evidentiary hearing before it could enforce the settlement. That is not the law in Minnesota. Counsel does cite to the VoiceStream case, which is applicable, but VoiceStream does not hold that a district court must hold an evidentiary hearing before it determines whether it needs to enforce a settlement. It simply says that if the court finds there are factual issues, it may hold an evidentiary hearing. But if you look at this case, the district court determined correctly, in my view, that there were no factual issues, and summary disposition was appropriate. And I think that makes sense, particularly when we look at the abuse of discretion standard of review in this case. This isn't a settlement agreement negotiated outside of court. It was presented to the court, read on the record. Judge Regis was present and again inquired of the appellant to make certain that there was clarity and an objective intention to enter into the settlement. Okay. So under those circumstances, I cannot see how this court could find error with the district court enforcing the terms of that settlement. Thank you. And unless there are any other questions, I'll yield the rest of my time.
It appears there are none.
Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. Ms. Nora, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court is reviewing the matters on appeal without the benefit of knowing, because it's an extensive documentary record, what the status of the respondent's proof of claim is in bankruptcy court. This proof of claim was already filed in the amount of $126,000, which led to the adversary proceeding for a determination of that value of that proof of claim with counterclaims attached for bringing a false claim in the bankruptcy court. This resolution that was being negotiated would have provided the respondent and its counsel, who is a third-party defendant in that action, a release for the mere consideration of allowing Mr. Baker to have some benefit of the negotiations. The court has properly asked, what is the value that was not determined by the grant of summary judgment? First of all, the grant of summary judgment was an interlocutory order and subject to appeal. So that is not a final determination.
Addition, well, it was granted in part and denied in part, correct?
Correct.
And then so some issues were determined with remaining issues for trial.
But it was not appealable at that time.
Understood.
So there's the value that Mr. Zahn cites, which I do not recall in the summary judgment decision, placed any monetary value on the hourly rate at all. He says that it determined an hourly rate. That is not what I recall. But the issue that the respondent...
No, so I mean, I agree with you that the district court's summary judgment decision did not define the monetary values of the claims, and I was asking for background information on that, presumably, you know, based upon evidence in the summary judgment record. But
right. Well, the matter was still completely in dispute for trial. The negotiations were to resolve the false proof of claim in Mr. Baker's assessment that was filed by the respondent. And when Mr. Zahn indicates that the value that he thinks was still in dispute, that's his interpretation of the respondent's rights with complete disregard of Mr. Baker's rights to appeal from the determination that summary judgment was warranted on the contract at all, because that was not yet appealable. It was greater than $10,000. The reason that I have referred to in bankruptcy court as the ultimate value of the respondent's claim, and this is dependent on how Mr. Baker resolves his other debt, which is unfortunately a non-dischargeable priority claim to the IRS, which we are still working on with his tax accountant to bring that down. I have always referred to this as a small claims level case based on the amount available for distribution to the respondent, but not with respect to Mr. Baker's rights to recover from a false proof of claim being placed before the bankruptcy court. That was the major consideration that was being offered to the respondent and its counsel, the third-party defendant, simply for accommodations on how to present the dollar value to the bankruptcy court. And instead, this has been derailed into a non-essential term argument when it's clear that the terms are essential, because after the appeal was undertaken, or simultaneously with our appeal, Mr. Zahn was demanding the accommodation that is not placed on the record with respect to the dismissal of the second adversary proceeding.
Before your time is up, I'd like to ask, with respect to your argument that the district court should have held an evidentiary hearing, what factual issues were in dispute then that could have been and should have been determined by the district court?
As to whether there was a meeting of the minds, which is an issue of fact.
And how would the testimony shed any further light on that? We have the arguments of counsel. We have the transcripts of the different proceedings.
Oh, I'm sorry. May I answer?
Yes, please go ahead.
Thank you. The meeting of the minds is, what did Mr. Baker consider to be essential? And the treatment of the claim and the associated resolution in bankruptcy court was essential to Mr. Baker, and as it turned out, also to the respondent and its counsel, by virtue of its September 10th, Mr. Zahn's September 10th, I believe it is, email to me. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days.